protected or to keep me away from Mr. Short. I couldn't ask. I didn't dare ask. And what answer could he have given that would have been a balm to my savage heart? "It's for the best," was all he said. And I sat there, staring up at the painted domed ceiling to keep hot tears of helpless anger from escaping the corners of my eyes, because what I thought best didn't matter. It wasn't even deemed proper for me to acknowledge my feelings for William, not to him, nor to my father, who had not felt the need to consult me. I'd had no say, no sway even in his decision to release William, nor in William's decision to go, or even whether or not I wanted to return to Virginia. And I never would have a say, because in the world outside the convent, men did as they pleased, and women were left to simply accept the consequences. But it seemed to me as if the world outside of the convent was both wicked and unjust, and the only place I could be happy was at the Panthéon, where I thrived in the company of friends and God. As autumn faded to darkest winter, and not a single letter arrived for me from William Short, the desire to remain at the Panthéon and take my vows grew more and more within me. And once I'd decided upon this course, the only question that remained was how to tell my father. Papa had discounted the faith to which I'd been called as superstitious and hostile in every country and every age to liberty. But I told myself that I didn't care if my spiritual calling made him angry. Perhaps I even hoped that it would. Still, my desires weren't born of mere petty rebellion. I'd have opportunities to teach in the convent. I could think on great matters and help shape the minds of young girls. It was a vocation, a calling, both earthly and spiritual, to be of consequence. And because the desire rose up in me so strongly, I resolved to tell Papa at Christmas. Why, then, having found comfort in God, did I feel consumed by hellfires? The very night I resolved to tell my father, shivering sent my teeth chattering, and yet I burned. Outside, the canals were impassable with ice, the Seine River frozen solid, preventing shipments of grain from reaching the city. The other girls huddled together in the convent to keep warm, but a fire consumed me from the inside, and a rash had broken out on my skin. Marie sent for an abbess. "Chère Jeffy has the typhus." By morning, Polly was sick, too. We were both sent from the convent to my father's home, with fear that we wouldn't recover. My recollection is hazy, for I suffered from bouts of delirium. I scarcely knew day from night. I have slight memories of white snow frosting the windows and howling drafts stealing through the blankets under which I tossed and turned. One thing, however, I remember with perfect clarity. It was my father himself who tended us and no one else. He lodged my sister and me in his own quarters, holding spoonfuls of gruel to our lips, urging us to take sips of wine, wiping our brows, cleaning our messes, and singing us little songs. The illness didn't swiftly pass over us, and while my father's constant attentions helped ease my pain, Polly couldn't be comforted. She suffered that bitter winter, through what Papa said was a Siberian degree of cold. And all the time, he was never far from us. He never uttered a harsh word, no matter how often we called to him for water or cool, damp cloths. He was so tender and motherly in a time I was desperate for both, that I forgot my resentments, forgot everything but my love for him, as we were drawn together again in the fear of losing Polly. One afternoon, I called to her from my bed and she didn't answer. In terror, I screamed, "Papa, make her answer! Make her answer me!" In sweat-stained white shirt sleeves that matched his exhausted pallor, my father kissed the damp curls on my sister's brow.
"She can't hear you," he whispered, rocking Polly. "The fever has robbed her of hearing."
My little sister wasn't dead, but in a stupor, deaf and insensible. At Christmas, Polly could no longer open her eyes. We had no hope she'd live to see the new year. I half dreamed I saw my mother in our room with angel's wings. But when I woke, I wondered if it was only the white lace curtain at the drafty window. When I asked my father if Mama was watching over us, he lowered his head to his hands and was quiet a long time.
"I'd like it to be true. You'll never know how I long for her even still."
The memory of my mother's face had faded for me. Her voice I couldn't remember at all. There had been in me over the years a slow and gentle farewell. But he'd written on her gravestone that she'd been torn from him in death. He may have given up chasing her into the grave, but he was, even all these years later, still bleeding from what he considered a violent parting. I think it was that desperation that drove him to work harder than any man I ever knew in a cause he deemed greater than himself. And in the midst of my fevered illness, when I had energy only for thoughts and little else, my heart ached in sympathy and sadness. For I was nearly certain that Polly was to be torn from us, too. That night, I knelt over Polly's bedside and steepled my hands in urgent prayer. "Please save Polly. Save my sister's life, and I'll give myself over to you. I'll find the courage to tell my father. Take me as your bride and let her go. Take me and let her live." The next morning, Polly opened her eyes. In the days that followed, her rash disappeared, her fever abated, and she answered when we called, her deafness cured. But Polly's mind never entirely recovered. In the months that followed, she suffered from a torpor of intellect. When we returned to the convent school, Polly struggled with her studies, and by springtime, it was manifestly evident that the bright little girl who had charmed Abigail Adams with her cheek and sassed me into exasperation was no more. Nevertheless, God had answered my prayer. The bargain had been struck. I was bound by my promise to take my vows and didn't despair of it. It had been almost 7 months since Mr. Short left on his tour of the continent, never writing a line to me in all that time. This painful silence ensured that I didn't see for myself a future as any man's wife, so why shouldn't I welcome the convent as my sanctuary and salvation? My friends at the Pantheon helped me to practice the words to tell Papa, but no combination of utterances ever seemed to capture everything I felt. And not even putting it to paper made it come out right. Still, I knew I must find a way before my father took us back to Virginia. The matter was decided for me one Sunday in mid-April, when Polly and I returned to the Hôtel de Langeac to find Sally wearing a fashionable new dress in crimson damask that matched the ribbon for her locket. Sally had a trunk full of new clothes, too. Papa had bought her expensive silks and satins, petticoats and stockings, ribbons and heeled shoes, things she'd never have need of were she to return to our plantation in Virginia. I doubted Sally had asked for any of this largesse. My father had spoiled her, either because he felt responsible or infatuated with her. Or perhaps he spoiled her because it eased his conscience for the way he'd once used her. Was it possible that he meant to free her, and leave her here in France when we returned home? Or did he intend to keep Sally Hemings with him,
even as he made plans to send me and my sister back to Virginia. The suspicion made me as sad as it made me angry, and because I was 16 years old, it finally felt right to tell him my adult inclinations. Chapter 11. Paris, 18 April, 1789. To Thomas Jefferson, from Patsy. I ask your blessing to take my vows and join the Holy Order of the Convent, where I intend to live out my days with my new sisters. This letter and all the others I ever sent my father are carefully preserved within these wooden filing presses. My father always said my letters were precious to him. I believe it now as never before. And as I hold this letter above the candle flame, for I cannot let it survive, I remember how my hands shook to write it in the first place, all those years ago. I'd never feared my father before. I'd feared for him, but never before had I dreaded seeing him as I did the day I sent this letter. At the convent, awaiting his reply, time passed so slowly I found myself checking and rechecking the tall case clock that stood sentinel over the library as it counted out the minutes and chimed at the quarter hours. But Papa didn't send a reply that night. Part of me knew he wouldn't. When he rode up in the carriage the next day for our weekly visit, I was afraid to meet his eyes. Thankfully, he gave no evidence that anything was amiss. Instead, he took us to the Palais Royal, a center of gardens, theaters, shops, and cafes, with gentlemen's clubs open from noon to midnight. I never tired of shopping amongst ladies with frilly parasols and gentlemen being carried in sedan chairs under the colonnade. But on that day, I could barely stand the unspoken tension, waiting for my father to acknowledge the note that I'd sent him. It wasn't until evening that Papa called me to sit with him, alone, where he sipped at wine by the fire. "Has someone at the convent proselytized to you on the subject of religion?" "Never," I replied, knowing how much it'd displease him if the answer were otherwise. He stared down into his wine, which glowed like a garnet in the firelight. "In my role as ambassador, I've been made aware of the plight of an American girl schooled in a convent just like you. She's somehow been seduced into remaining there as a nun, thereby abandoning her country, her relations, and her religion. And yet, even learning this, never did I think my own daughter was just as vulnerable." Papa's characterization of a religious epiphany as seduction made my belly knot. Worse was his assertion that taking my vows would amount to abandoning my family and country. How could I argue for my convictions when the man who opposed me was both beloved and formidable? I tucked my hands between my knees so he wouldn't see them shake. "Would you forbid me to follow the dictates of my conscience?" He pinched the bridge of his nose, as if the question gave him great pain. "Patsy, you're young and inexperienced. This decision needs more time and consideration. Mature reflection." His words were unbearably familiar. They sounded like Mr. Short's description of his own conversation with Papa, which also turned on the subject of youth and inexperience. And heat crawled up my neck. My father and I seldom spoke in open disagreement, only circling about subjects of contention without touching them directly. Yet this time, I felt as if he allowed me no avenue of retreat, and for once, I said just what I believed. "I'm old enough now to judge my own happiness." My father took a long drink before returning his glass to the table beside his stuffed chair. He squinted, lines of hurt etching his face. How can you think to be happy separated by an ocean from your sister and me?
I'd expected him to be angry. Instead, he was wounded. Yet I bristled defensively. I could ask the same of you. Don't you intend to leave us in Virginia and return to France?
His brows knitted together, as if he'd never considered I might object. My commission won't keep me in Paris forever. 5 years I've served in France, while my own country formed a new government in my absence. I'll stay only as long as duty requires. Very soon I'll retire from public life to Monticello. I've always looked to you to render the evening of my life serene and contented, never realizing you loved me so little.
Guilt formed a lump in my throat that nearly prevented me from speech. Then my words tumbled out all at once. That isn't true, Papa. Of course I love you, and it isn't that I want to be without you.
Then why would you wish to take the veil?
Papa liked to have an iron discipline over himself. He never raised his voice, seldom let emotions rule. But now, to my horror, that self-control cracked, and all traces of the seasoned diplomat, the dispassionate philosopher, the objective scientist fell away. Tears sprang to his eyes as he beseeched me.
Have I failed you so utterly as a father?
My heart beat a fast and painful cadence. He had failed me. But that wasn't the whole of the story, or even the largest part of it. And at the sight of his anguish, tears welled in my eyes, too. My dearest Papa, please believe that I'd never leave you or my country except for God. But I did not tell him of my faith. Instead, breathlessly, I told him of my bargain. When I finished, he said,
Oh, Patsy, it'd be more pardonable to believe in no God at all than in one who bargains like a pirate for the life of a little girl. That God would be a demon. You mustn't feel bound by such a promise. Not when it would make me so unbearably unhappy.
Leaning forward, he grasped my fingers, and it was his gnarled and injured hand that trembled, not mine.
Patsy, I rely on you for the evening of my life, because you know, as no one knows, that the morning of my life was clouded by loss after loss. I have nothing left but you.
The beseeching tone of his words stole my response. But my thoughts raced. What of Polly? The question swam silently on the tip of my tongue as he sank to his knees before me, like a penitent, holding my face in his hands, overwhelming me with his emotion.
My dear girl, nobody in this world can make me happy or miserable as you. You've been my constant companion in my darkest hours. I'd be lost without you.
Lost. His supplication at my feet melted the edges of my anger and left only a desperate need to mend what I'd broken. I'd never wish to grieve you so, Papa. I only wish to serve God's demand. Then we were both sobbing. My father's forehead pressed to mine, our tears mingling.
Patsy, a just God would never demand this of you. I know what it is to be truly bound by a vow, for I made one to your mother.
He stopped to pull from his coat pocket the engraved gold watch key in which he'd preserved my mother's hair beneath clear glass.
I swear again, here and now, that I'll never take another wife. I'll always be alone. So if I'm obliged to leave you here, shut up in a convent, it would be as much a grief to me as shoveling dirt over your grave, and I'd pray for someone to soon shovel dirt over mine.
I was truly shaken.
I'd not seen my father in such a state since the night he stared down his pistols. I remembered our solitary rides. Those days he lay prostrate after my mother's death. Here in Paris, he stood so much taller, a giant amongst men. I hadn't realized, or perhaps I had forgotten, that he needed me, just as my mother said he would. And hadn't I made a vow to her before I made one to God? For a time, I'd forgotten my vow. But Papa's misery put me in doubt of my decision. Had I been seduced? Seduced by my own sadness and heartbreak? Perhaps I did need more time to think, more time to decide. My father had been for so long everything to me. My sun, my moon, my stars. No other being, not even William Short, had ever exerted such force in my universe as my father. So it's true that Papa never forbade me from my vocation as a nun, but it is equally true that he didn't think he needed to. Though I remained unsure, Papa clearly considered the matter decided. And the very next day, he rode up to the convent gates in a carriage and told Polly and me to gather all our belongings. Then my father paid our tuition in full, closing our account, and we rode away from the Panthémon in silence.
Mademoiselle Jefferson, would you do me the honor of a dance?
The question was put to me in the opulent gilded ballroom, following a regal bow by the Marquis de Lafayette. He was, at that time, an elegant man of 31, at the height of his power and his beauty. The heroic soldier, who was no less handsome for the long slope of his forehead beneath his powdered wig, had rescued us from the British when I was but a child. Now he rescued me again, by singling me out for attention at my debut, and I couldn't help but wonder if Papa had put him up to it. In the days after my withdrawal from the convent, Papa undertook what I believed to be a campaign to distract me from my desire to take my vows. He gifted me with a gold watch on a chain. He arranged for riding lessons so that we could ride together as we used to, just the two of us. And he spent 300 francs on new ball gowns for my coming out during the social season, jesting that I would be limited to only 3 balls a week. Already bewitched by the glow of the many candles burning in glittering crystal chandeliers overhead, my friends giggled and exclaimed in wonder behind their fans. All evening we'd been gathered against a wall of gilded paintings, watching ladies and lords pass us by in powdered wigs and swishing petticoats. The Tufton sisters wore matching pink brocade, and Marie a patterned dark blue silk with lace frothing at her elbows. I towered above my friends in shimmering bronze, my hair styled in a wild halo of red curls, a braid looped behind, all ornamented with ribbons and peacock feathers. To Lafayette, I curtsied my gratitude and acceptance. Merci. On the dance floor, we circled one another with intricate footwork, touching hands, then retreating. When we came together with the music, the aristocrat said,
I should envy you for your graceful dancing, mademoiselle. Yet because I'm dancing with you, I am the envy of every man on the floor.
I didn't know how to reply to such courtly flattery, except by blushing furiously. When the music next brought us close, Lafayette insisted,
Send my regards to your father. I see too little of him of late, and I hear disturbing rumors that he intends to return to Virginia.
I didn't want to confirm it, in part because I didn't want it to be so myself. Instead, I smiled as if I hadn't heard over the music. When the dance was done,
Lafayette led me back to my friends, saying, "Tell your papa I'll call upon him soon. Mr. Jefferson is still very much needed here in Paris, where his revolution remains undone. In my study, I have a copy of his Declaration of Independence in half a frame. The other half of the frame is empty. One day, with his help, it will house a declaration of French rights, and they'll stand side by side like proud brothers, like France and America, like your father and me."
Ordinarily, a man's importance can be judged only by the passage of time. But in those years of convulsive political change, we knew we walked amongst living legends, and my father was one of them. That's why Lafayette's worshipful words echoed long after our dance, a lingering reminder that my father had never belonged only to me, or to me and my sisters, or even to my mother. His true mistress had always been the Revolution, the Republic, the Enlightenment. Given that profound calling and all the people who looked to my father for inspiration, was it really so silly or selfish that I desired a calling of my own? I couldn't help but wonder. And yet, as much as I still thought about my desire to take my vows, I very much enjoyed French society. As the daughter of a foreign minister, I was welcomed into the highest circles. As an American, I was a curiosity, which garnered me invitations to many balls. I accepted them all, and not only because I loved to dance. I also went because the ballroom reunited me with my bosom friends from the convent. We filled our cards, danced late into the night, and dined past midnight, returning home at unorthodox hours. Marie flirted with gentlemen by dangling her white gloves and taught me to fend them off with a slow wave of my fan. Together, we mastered the subtle language of the ballroom, in which entire conversations took place in gestures.
"Fille de pute!" Marie cursed the night she wasn't asked to dance. "The men all stare at you for your height and that red hair. If I did not love you so much, Jeffy, I would rip it from your head."
"I'm merely a freckled American curiosity." It was true that in a ballroom, I attracted the notice of young men who might have overlooked me on the street. But I don't think it was my height or red hair, or even my dancing skills that drew them to me. I think it was because I held myself unattainable. I'd already foolishly given my heart to a man who abandoned me. I wouldn't make that mistake again. So I remained cordial but cool to the man who asked me to dance, and found myself flattered by admirers and overwhelmed by male attention, bewildered and intrigued. My most ardent suitor by far was the young and energetic Armand Jules-Marie Heracle, son of the Duke of Polignac, who, upon making my acquaintance, drew my hand up to kiss as if I were of rank to offer, and said, "Enchanté." The Polignacs were amongst the most powerful families at the court, and my suitor's mother a great favorite of Queen Marie Antoinette. The Chevalier, who some afforded the courtesy title of prince, challenged me with an aristocratic bearing. "Do you care to test your American pionnier fortitude against my stamina?" I accepted, and we danced a lively cotillion that had me sweating at the back of the neck. When the dance master called the next dance, Polignac said simply, "Again?" "But that's not permitted," I replied, fanning my flaming cheeks, for we could not dance twice in succession without inviting scandal. "Then the dance after that," he said, with a rakish smile, "give me the honor of every other dance, mademoiselle." Polignac was brash and pleasant to look at in his sea-green coat with its embroidered gold lapels. Papa would have been appalled by my deference to titled nobility,
but I found myself quite unable to refuse the son of a duke. Before the night was through, I'd danced 16 times, 8 of them with him. We caused a sensation, and I admit to feeling satisfaction at the brazenness of it. The ladies Tufton demanded, "Have you set your cap on a Polignac, Patsy?" and "Do you aim to be a duchess?" Marie hushed the Tufton sisters with a violent whack of her lace fan. "Tis toi." Then she turned shrewd eyes on me. "Chère, je fille est still in revolt against her papa. She has half the French court, whispering Jefferson's daughter will convert to the true faith. Now the other half will whisper Jefferson's daughter is in love with a nobleman." Marie saw in my behavior some spark of hostility, some lack of care for Papa's reputation, and I didn't want to think it was true. In love? No, I didn't love the Duke's son. I scarcely knew him. He wasn't William Short. He was merely a pretty distraction. And didn't my father want me distracted? The start of the French Revolution was orchestrated in my father's parlor. The leading reformers consulted Papa for every scrap of news of America. Our country's independence served as proof men could throw off the chains of tyranny and rule themselves. Though Polly and I always left the table before the men turned to port and tobacco and more heated political discussions, we heard enough to know that none of them, not Papa, nor any of the idealists gathered at our hearth in those early days, feared it would come to armed rebellion. The king had called for elections, and summoned the Estates General for the first time in more than a century and a half. It was taken as a clarion call to make a new government that gave a voice to the people. We were all excited. When the great day came, we were all awakened before dawn by the peal of bells and booming cannons that sent people into the streets in celebration. I helped Papa brush the shoulders of his best blue coat, while Sally hastily mended the button on his red waistcoat. With white breeches and a dark blue felted hat, he was entirely bedecked in the colors of American and French patriots, red, white, and blue. I wanted nothing more than to go along with him to witness the debates from the gallery, but Papa wouldn't have approved, even if he had an extra ticket. However, I was able to see the pageantry of the procession in the carriage of the elderly Madame de Tessé, the woman Lafayette called his aunt. Thousands crowded the streets, swarmed the rooftops of every building along the avenue, clapping and reciting the famous pamphlet, "What is the Third Estate? The whole people. What has it hitherto been in our form of government? Nothing. What does it want? To become something." Swept up in the excitement, I hummed along with the flutes and trumpets. Soldiers marched in blue coats with gold epaulettes, wearing their proud ranks of insignia. The king marched beneath a canopy covered in fleur-de-lis. The purple-robed bishops and red-robed cardinals chanted as they made their way to Versailles. The nobles strolled in rank, with gold sashes and feathered hats. Then came the sea of the Third Estate, representatives of the people, obliged to dress in Stygian black and slouchy hats to denote their inferior rank. That's all I saw of the opening day. It was not, however, my last visit to Versailles. So many great personages couldn't be gathered together in one place, even for such serious business, without evening entertainments. At the next ball, I danced again with the Duke's son, sending a scandalized titter through the politicized crowd, and a ripple of sighs for our precise steps so elegantly made in white-heeled shoes. We stopped only for refreshments near the sideboard table, dodging dripping wax from the candelabras overhead, and taking glasses of sweet wine from silver trays. My friends joined us, musing over whether or not we could sneak into the covert card game some aristocratic ladies had arranged in a private room upstairs. It was, of course, improper for women to play cards in public, or at all, but a certain duchess was an inveterate gambler.
"Speaking of dazzling duchesses," murmured my chevalier, "please excuse me, ladies. The lovely Rosalie has arrived, and I must pay my respects."
I turned to give my suitor a wave of farewell, but Marie grabbed my arm and pinched it so hard I yelped, "Mon Dieu, je fille, donne le cap!" It was too late. I'd already spotted the pretty Duchesse de la Rochefoucauld, and there, at her side, was William Short. Chapter 12. Our eyes locked across the crowded ballroom, never wavering, in spite of the servants passing with silver trays of bubbling pink champagne and crystal glasses. Without breaking my gaze, William Short whispered a quick word into his companion's bejeweled ear. I hated the sight of his cheeks so near to the porcelain skin of her shoulder and plunging décolletage, then hated more when he left her side to close the distance between us, striding between plumed ladies and men swaggering about with swords on their hips. Most violently, my heart tried to take flight, leaving me suddenly breathless and light-headed. I'd yearned for our reunion, but now that it was upon me, I felt utterly unprepared. As if sensing my plight, my friends circled to form a phalanx before me in a violent swish of petticoats and lace. Marie, who had the best reason to know the pain Mr. Short's long absence had caused me, didn't bother with subtle gestures. She rudely shook her dance program at him as if shooing away a fly.
"Ladies,"
wearing the warmest smile, Mr. Short ignored the flapping page and bowed.
"Miss Jefferson."
I just stared. 8 months he'd been absent. 8 months without a word. Wars had been fought and won in less time. Certainly my whole world had changed. Yet he addressed me as if a mere day had passed since our last visit. William Short ought not have presumed we were still friends. No, he ought not have presumed. I finally managed an icy, "Mr. Short, what a surprise."
"May I have a quiet word, Miss Jefferson?"
He scarcely waited for me to nod before herding me away from my coterie. I pulled away, not letting him touch me, not taking his arm, even as I followed him into an empty alcove where gold-tasseled curtains framed a tall, elegant window. I was so dizzied by his presence that the fleur-de-lis on the blue silk wallpaper danced before my eyes, but I refused to let him see how affected I was. I crossed my arms, seething. "I had no word you were back in Paris, Mr. Short."
"I just arrived in the past hour, actually, which explains my state of dress."
It was then that I realized how out of place he looked in a dark coat and breeches, an outfit more fit for travel than the ballroom.
I feared I might be denied entrance, but fortunately, Rosalie vouched for me.
The gall of mentioning her to me in this moment. My gaze narrowed and my tone chilled even more. "Fortunate indeed." Mr. Short winced and shook his head.
"I only meant to make clear that I came straight away from your father's house."
Accustomed to loss and calamity, I was thrown into instant worry and dropped my arms. "Has something happened to Papa? To Polly?"
He stepped closer. "No, they're both well. But I didn't want to miss seeing you tonight, so I dared not delay in coming here."
I frowned. He wanted me to believe he'd come to the ball to see me. I could scarcely credit that. I'm very curious to know what has happened to make you so suddenly remember my existence.
His hand went to his heart. I never forgot you, Patsy. Never.
I quite nearly snorted. Men were apt to say sweet nothings. Some men more than others, and Mr. Short was a practiced diplomat. How could I trust anything he said? It sent a surge of rage through my veins, but rage was a forbidden emotion, so I forced myself to be aloof, to resist his flattery and his handsome face as I'd resisted all the other men in Parisian ballrooms. I waved my fan. "Will you be returning to my father's service at the Hôtel de Langeac?"
Eagerly.
"Mon Dieu!" When he lived at the embassy before, I spent most of my days and nights at the convent. Must we now live together under the same roof? I thought it such an injustice I could manage only a bland nicety. "Well, then, welcome back, Mr. Short. My father will be happy for your return."
"Patsy," he said, drawing nearer still, "please don't retreat behind a polite facade."
An ache of desire opened up inside my chest, an ache my heart said would only be assuaged by giving in to his entreaties, but I still remembered how much worse was the pain of the heartbreak he'd caused. "I cannot imagine what you mean."
"You and your father both do it. But whereas Mr. Jefferson can't help himself, being too vulnerable otherwise, you're resilient enough to say what you think and feel."
How his words provoked me. Certain that I'd make a fool of myself, I didn't flee. I snapped, "Mr. Short, be glad I'm not ill-mannered enough to say what I think and feel. You must excuse me. They're calling the next dance."
Regret and contrition slipped into the cast of his green eyes. "You're angry."
"Ladies are never angry."
I was livid. He blocked my avenue of escape. "Ladies and angels are never angry, but Amazons..."
I didn't laugh at his little joke. Instead, I felt penned in, tormented by his use of words that had once meant something between us. My words came out as a hiss, leaking past the tight seal of my lips. "You never sent me a letter. Never in all the months you were gone."
"How could I, without offending your father? I asked after you whenever I wrote to him and sent my best wishes. You've no idea the anxiety it put in me to hear that you and your sister were so very ill this winter."
That had been months ago. Whatever anxiety he felt wasn't enough to make him return, not enough to mean anything. "You can see for yourself that I've recovered."
"Yes."
His green eyes traveled with appreciation down my face, over the pale mounds of my bosom, which heaved over the gold satin bows on my gown. Finally, his gaze moved up again, on an intake of breath.
"Beautifully."
He touched my cheeks. "They're calling the next dance," I reminded him, my own breath shallow. "I've promised another dance to..."
"Polignac?" Mr. Short turned to see the approach of my chevalier. "Refuse him."
"Outrageous. What cause do I have to be so rude to a suitor?"
"Refuse him,"
Mr. Short repeated, more emphatically.
"Tell him you're tired. Tell him you're ill. Tell him..." "I don't care what you tell him, but refuse him."
Gripping my closed fan, I gave an exasperated shake of my head. "Why should I? Why would you even ask such a thing of me?"
"Because I hate him," Mr. Short said with uncharacteristic malice. "He's a monarchist, an enemy of liberty. And more importantly, you just called him your suitor. You've danced with him before."
Having let loose my temper, it now slipped dangerously out of my control at this apparent show of jealousy. "Why should you mind? You left me feeling quite a fool, and I will not be fooled again."
"Patsy."
William's unsettling green eyes pleaded with me from beneath sandy lashes. He shook his head and sighed.
I'm going about this all wrong. Please, I'll beg 1,000 pardons if you'll only give me the chance to explain myself.
Before I could answer, I was forced to contend with the expectant gaze of the Duke's son. Extending a hand to me that displayed the most elegant lace cuff I've ever seen, the Chevalier asked,
Mademoiselle, is this dance not promised to me?
Yes, it is. I braved a look at William Short, whose expression barely masked his displeasure at the other man's interruption. Confusion so gripped me that the decision was more instinctual than purposeful. But I'm afraid I'm feeling dizzy. Will you forgive me for sitting out? The Chevalier narrowed his eyes in concern and glanced between us.
Please, if you're unwell, mademoiselle, let me see you to...
Mr. Short stepped between us.
I'll tend her, Polignac.
The two men must have been acquainted, because a poisonous look passed between them. In fact, the Chevalier wouldn't withdraw until I rested my fingertips upon Mr. Short's arm.
As you wish, Mademoiselle Chefferson, Polignac said, as if he no longer knew quite how to pronounce my name. Another evening, perhaps?
Given his high color, I doubted very much that there'd be other evenings with the Duke's son, as he'd obviously taken my refusal for a snub. I ought to have chased after him and explained myself. But all I wanted was to hear what William Short had to say. Infuriatingly, he said nothing. Instead, he guided me to the grand marble staircase, wrought in iron and tipped with gold. Arm in arm we descended. Together, very slowly. Finally, he said,
I never meant to leave you feeling a fool.
A hollowness filled my chest. Then why did you, without a word of explanation?
Please understand that a year ago, when I begged a hearing of your father on the matter of my feelings for you, he made clear that he still considered you a mere schoolgirl. Too young to be wooed, much less wed.
I suspected as much. Nevertheless, I swallowed on the word wed. Didn't you try to persuade him otherwise?
And risk losing his esteem forever? No, Patsy. Only time would persuade him my intentions were honorable. So I gave us that time by traveling, by trying to convince your father in my letters that I want to provide for a wife and a family.
I sniffed, trying to hold firm against the words I'd long yearned to hear. He said nothing to me of these letters.
Your father cannot have mistaken my meaning because he wrote with advice on how I might best build a fortune with which to support a wife. Now I've returned to Paris to find everything changed.
Changed how?
His gaze searched mine. The moment I set foot in the Hotel de Langeac tonight, I asked after you. Your father told me that you were no longer in the convent, and that he'd let you come out into French society.
Had Papa also confided in him my desire to take my vows as a nun? While I wondered, Mr. Short stopped on the landing and put his hand on the railing.
That's why I came straight away to find you. I knew, at long last, I could speak openly. I didn't want to let another hour, not another second, tick by without declaring myself.
I swayed on my heeled shoes, quite fearing a swoon. What is it you wish to declare?
He looked down, almost shyly. I've so often planned what I'd say in this moment that it should be ready on my tongue. But poetry has suddenly fled from me. How can I find the words?
I stared expectantly, wondering if he might dare to take my hand and kiss it, if he might scandalously twine his fingers with mine, if he might lean close to whisper in my ear. Instead,
He reached into his coat and pulled forth the little piece of folded paper, now worn and creased with time, and unfolded it for me to see my hair still pressed within.
"Patsy, this token has never left my possession. It's been a reminder every day. What I want to declare, what I want to offer, is quite beyond abiding friendship."
I gulped, then forgot to breathe. "You kept my hair all this time?"
"Yes, near my heart. A year ago, I adored you. But now I adore you even more than before, for you've grown into a graceful and beautiful woman."
How could I believe him? Perhaps I was graceful, shapely too, with the added allure of an ample bosom and ginger hair. But even then, in the flower of my youth, I knew that I wasn't so much beautiful as appealing, my face a delicate rendering of my father's. Maybe it was the very resemblance to my father that accounted for the beauty Mr. Short saw in me, for I was a feminine reflection of a man he idolized. But still, I was wary. "There are prettier ladies in Paris."
"Not in my eyes,"
he insisted emphatically. Now he did draw my hand up and clasp it against his chest, where I felt his heart throb beneath the buttons of his waistcoat, evidence that he did think me beautiful. That, in turn, made me feel beautiful. It was a heady, intoxicating feeling, a feeling that could rob a girl of all reason.
"Patsy, will you allow me to walk you home?"
In that moment, I'd have gone anywhere with him. It didn't matter that my feet ached from dancing, or that I'd left my shawl upstairs, or even that my chaperone would soon notice I was missing. That spring in Paris, defiance of rules was the norm, and a wild, defiant liberation had taken hold of me, so I didn't fight it. I simply went with him out into the night and alighted a carriage back to Paris, quite undone by this turn of fate. My thoughts were as tumultuous as the jostling ride. I'd built a fortification round my heart, and not only because I'd been hurt. Given my intention to take my vows, I was forced to wonder if Mr. Short was a temptation sent by the devil himself. If so, I was ready to fall into the devil's arms, but I wasn't so unprincipled as to deceive him. When we disembarked on the Champs-Élysées beneath lamps hung in the trees, I turned to him.
"Mr. Short, I'm very much changed since you left. You don't realize the full extent of it. When you learn more, I fear you must reconsider your declaration."
"That sounds ominously serious."
"I'm afraid it is."
I told him of my bargain with God, of my admittedly wavering belief that I'd been called to serve as a bride of Christ, rather than the bride of any man. When I was finished, he exhaled.
"What a relief. I feared you'd given your heart to Polignac. I'm much happier to have God as a rival. More glory in it for me if I win your love, and less shame should I lose."
I gasped at his playful remark. "That's blasphemous."
He winked. "Probably so. I'm a sinner with more faults than you imagine, Patsy. But you're the friend to which my soul is unalterably attached, so I'm prepared to make whatever alterations to my character would be conducive to your happiness. Only tell me this. Are my hopes in vain, or can you be induced to love me?"
I loved him already. Had loved him, it seemed, all my life. Loved his loyalty, his ambition, his radical vision for the world. That a man like William Short wanted my love filled me with such joy that I could have thrown my arms about his neck, heedless of the eyes upon us,
and confessed it on the spot. But did I not love God just as much? Even if I hadn't determined to take the veil, I'd been strictly taught that a girl's easy confession of love was indecent and would destroy that love. I couldn't answer him with true candor. Worse, in struggling to think of a reply of sufficient restraint, I uttered words he took for reproach. "Sir, your absence pained me more than I can ever express."
"You cannot forgive me,"
he asked, stiffening. "I could forgive you anything, but I need time to petition heaven for guidance."
"You're cruel, Miss Jefferson. I've already spent a year's time waiting for you."
I shook my head. "It's not cruelty, but confusion. For in that year's time, I feared you despised me. Now, in one night, everything I thought I knew is changed."
"You feel hurried. Yes, I see that now. As do I. For your father tells me he expects permission for his leave of absence in the post any day now, and that you'll set sail for Virginia. I saw the trunks, already packed."
The breath went out of me. I hadn't forgotten my father's congé, but I hadn't realized that the need for a decision would steal swiftly upon me. Now, here was Mr. Short, making my choice more complicated. "But I need to understand, if I loved you, what then?"
His hands tightened on mine. "Then you'd make me the happiest man who ever lived."
His words radiated warm joy through me, but his answer didn't tell me what I needed to know. "And what of our future?"
He smiled. "If you could give up all thoughts of the convent, our future depends upon the orders your father is awaiting from America. Your father has asked that in his absence I be appointed in his place as chargé d'affaires with commensurate salary. If I receive such an appointment, then I can present myself to your father as a worthy suitor. Otherwise, I'm afraid he'll consider me a wandering wastrel without employment."
"He would never..."
Mr. Short chuckled mirthlessly. "You think not? I have in my possession a letter from your father lecturing me on the need to build my fortune. The most memorable line reads, 'This is not a world in which heaven rains down riches into any open hand.'"
How churlish of Papa. But had I not from the youngest age also received letters filled with his lectures? "You mustn't worry, Mr. Short. If my father requested your appointment, then it's sure to come. But until it does, how can I be sure of your intentions in asking for my love?" I didn't expect him to laugh.
"You're Jefferson's daughter to the bone. You want evidence. Well, give me the chance, and I'll give you the proofs you require, both of my love and of the world you should love too much to abandon even for God. I wouldn't have you enter a convent, much less love in ignorance."
"What do you think me ignorant of?" With mischief twinkling in his eyes, he stopped, drawing me into a grove of trees. Beyond us, in the ditch, we heard boys playing a ball game in the dim lamplight. Somehow, in the dark, Mr. Short's fingertips found my cheeks, and his mouth stole over mine. This first kiss was soft and tender, as if he feared frightening me. Nevertheless, it shocked me. It was like my heart was a loaded cannon he'd held fire to, and it threatened to shoot out of my chest. But I wasn't frightened, and I didn't pull away. Instead, it seemed quite the most natural thing to kiss him back, mimicking what he did, glorying in every soft, sweet sensation. At the feel of my lips teasing softly at his, he groaned and pulled back. Oh, my heart! The sweet taste of him still on my lips, our breaths puffing in the night air, I asked, "Have I done something wrong?
He held my cheeks in his hands. The error was all mine. I'd beg your pardon if I could bring myself to regret it. But I never want to regret anything with you, so tonight I must content myself with one kiss.
Only one? I wanted to lavish 1,000 kisses on his face, his lips,